Hey, it's me, James Stacey, and this episode of Hodinkee Radio is a rare treat because we're doing it live. Well, not really, but I'm in New York, so we're doing it face-to-face. No Zoom required. As such, I've dragged Cole, Danny, and Jack into the offices on a beautiful Wednesday morning to chat about watches we regret selling and watches we totally don't regret selling. As I'm sure we've all flipped a few pieces in the past, some perhaps a bit too hastily, it should be a fun walk down memory lane. Let's get to it. Hey guys, nice to see your faces in a traditional non-monitor sort of sense. Although I guess we did this not too long ago in Geneva. It's cool to be back in New York. I mean, it's not functionally cool. It's a sauna in the room where we're recording. Jack is complaining a lot. I've muted his microphone. How we all doing?
I'm dying.
I'm very warm.
Yeah, I'm just dying.
It's that in-between time. I guess you have to explain though. Like in New York, when the seasons change, the heating is controlled by the building, right? So that doesn't necessarily change with the seasons, yeah. Right on time. So it's spring, it's nice out, but the heat's on in the building.
Also, it's a steam radiator. And typically the steam radiators in Manhattan were designed to overdo it because a lot of them date from like the period 1930 to 1960. And the idea was, it was thought that if you didn't keep the windows open and keep freshening the air, then miasmas that caused diseases would build up inside. So the radiators are basically designed to keep... rooms warm, even when it's extremely cold outside.
This is Reference Points Radiators Edition. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, radiators aren't the only ones that were designed to overdo it. I think that stands for most of us on this recording today. So we're trying to figure out a topic, and something that always does kind of come up, especially now with how the value of watches has really accelerated in the last few years, is you look back on stuff and you kind of think like, oh, maybe I should have kept that and sold it maybe now. Or you just regret it because you see a picture of it on your Instagram or you go back, you know, deleting photos from your photo roll and you're like, oh yeah, that was a good watch. Why did I sell that? So we thought we'd try and make that into some sort of a grander discussion. And anyone listening, if you have regrets or non-regrets as far as selling or buying watches, drop them in the comments. Of course, as always, we love to try and keep the combo going afterwards in the comments. So yeah, I mean, I think we should probably just jump right into it. What do you guys have in your history as far as, I don't know, maybe some of you regret selling a watch that you look back on and you kind of think like, maybe I shouldn't have.
I'll start from the beginning here. Let's start from the very beginning. I think I've talked about it before. You and I kind of come from the same era of like Fricker cased micro brands and forth. So there was a whole craft of watches that I owned that were not necessarily expensive. They were cheap, like Orsa Monstrum. You remember those?
Yep.
The Helios Shark Hunter, Shark Diver, not Helios. Oh, Helsin.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I've Helsin. Had a few Helsin Shark yeah. Divers.
And like the crazy thing is, yeah, I let them all go and I have never seen another one like Ocean Sevens or Nautic Fish or any of those early micro brand stuff. Let them go for cheap. And I've never seen another one to buy back.
Yeah.
And I just want to buy them for the nostalgia, to be honest.
For sure.
And I just have not seen them.
Well, and you had an LM7 as well, right? Which is Ocean 7's like Ploprof homage.
Exactly. Yeah, I had.
This is also kind of cool watch.
Very cool.
You wrote
cool
a story
watch.
On that, didn't you?
I did.
Okay.
And it's no longer in the collection, unfortunately. However, and that's one that I do regret selling, you know? which is kind of the point of this whole thing, right? But yeah, I was just kind of like going. The earliest phase of flipping or whatever was getting rid of all the micros,
yep.
Which I actually do regret simply. Not because they're valuable or anything now. They didn't pop. You just can't find them. There was a very specific era of watches that hasn't happened again, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I had a handful back in the day of Ocean Sevens and Orsas and, you know, these brands that, and there are definitely some that I look back on and I go like, that was too big. I understand why I sold that or like it didn't really work out. But I do miss a couple of them. A couple of them were really sweet things and they would kind of connect me back to those like really early days where you were finding something a little different or left of center from a Seiko SKX or something.
When did the era of crowdfunding micro brands kind of start?
1415?
Yeah, 1415 with Kickstarter. You know, very dangerous time to be into watches and not understand how Kickstarter doesn't work a lot.
That was also, the time when, like, I think wider public interest in watches kind of like outside the hardcore enthusiast community started to take off. So, like, you have all of these people coming into the hobby and there's these, like, you know, they're looking for something that's kind of unique, kind of specific. This Kickstarter comes up. It's like, you know, the watch looks cool. The price sounds right. Mm-hmm. And it's tempting, right?
I think everyone thought that they could do what Daniel Wellington did, which was, you know, take a watch that maybe cost $12 and sell it for $115. And then suddenly everyone was wearing them. The watch had no real gender bias. They were everywhere. And I think that's like people saw their opportunity to do the same thing with a Ronda Quartz or a Miyota Quartz and pump out, you know, several thousand watches per round of Kickstarter funding. But I've said this, I think, on this podcast before, like, I think I'm 1 for 5 on Kickstarter where, like, I just never got the thing. It just never happened.
Never got the watch.
I've never bothered with a watch.
Okay.
But like random tech items, sure. Camera gear, stuff like that. Like a camera strap, I think I bought, and I got that. But like Kickstarter can be like really fraught as far as a platform for any of this stuff. So I try and preach as much, you know, understand that if you do the Kickstarter thing, especially for something like a watch brand that's never made a watch before, the first one's the hardest.
So like is this the way it works? I've never actually like looked into Kickstarter all that much, but if you start a watch brand and you're trying to fund it through Kickstarter and you don't reach the minimum stated financial goal, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to give the money back?
Well, you don't get the money if you don't cross the threshold. I think it's held by Kickstarter is my understanding. And I could be a little bit off by that, but I don't think that if it's not funded, it's not funded. The project didn't work out.
Right.
In my experience with Kickstarter, the projects would fund and then the people just go dark. They take the money and they run.
That's interesting. Sounds like a great way to make an easy 50 grand.
I thought of one, by the way, a more specific example, Baffy's Hawaii.
Oh,
I
had one. Okay, so that was on my list. This is a fun one.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a 100 fathoms with the ruthenium dial, mm-hmm. the shiny sort of grayish dial.
The mother of pearl-ish one or no?
It was in the vein. Like it's just kind of a kind of flaky, bright silver sort of finish. And I absolutely regret selling that watch. It was super really cool. Did. It was the right size.
And totally unique viewpoint.
Yeah.
No, do you know those, Danny?
I don't.
This is a whole nother era of like watches. I would say early 2000s.
Okay.
Early 2000s
micro brands?
Yes.
Yeah, before we were even calling them micro brands, I think.
Yeah,
it was just like, one of these foreign brands, right?
Yeah, foreign brands, right.
Had a really specific design impetus to kind of make like an everyday kind of casual sport watch, but they had their own kind of look and feel. Do you remember the one did you have one with the UV case? So
mine
it was like
was
a
DLC
purple finished case.
Oh, I remember that one. No,
I thought that would be rad to have as well.
Yeah, that was. I remember on the case back, it had a depiction of Hawaii, which is very cool. The
Yeah. No, super cool. I definitely missed that watch. That was a great one. Good memory.
Yeah.
The picture of Hawaii, was it all of the islands or just the Big Island or?
All of
it. It was the chain, yeah.
Yeah, it was the chain, yeah. And I always wondered, so obviously Baffy's Hawaii moved into atomic timekeeping and so forth. And then after that, to my knowledge, they kind of exited.
Yeah,
exit stage
sure.
left, you know?
Yeah, I always wanted them to kind of like stick with the atomic watch project, but there are chip size atomic clocks available now that would make size wise a wristwatch atomic clock possible. I think the problem is still power consumption though.
I'll throw another one out there too. I used to collect Flightmasters specifically, like almost every, at some point I had every iteration except for the all gold one, which is my fantasy watch, like grail watch. And
it's gotta be a heavy sucker.
They all gold Flightmaster. You just got to try it. Just, it's better on the wrist.
Oh, no, right? I believe you. I believe you. I mean, in general, I find I've only had steel Flightmasters on, but in general, I find they're a lot more comfortable than you would think just from the size and the thickness of the case.
Totally.
And I mean, you do have to kind of lean into it, though. You're wearing like a honking big, super technical mechanical pilot's watch. And like, you know, you can't look at it and say, oh, well, I will think I'll stick with my 32 millimeter minute repeater for Pataphilippe.
And yeah, unfortunately, and this is a universal experience with watches, although there are, and I've encountered more and more people who just don't sell watches, period. But you go so deep on something, you come to understand it so intimately and so forth that you almost get to a point where you reject it. I don't know if this is a thing or not, but it certainly happens.
No,
to me.
I think that that's, I think that that's true. Like it's not even, I don't know if it's rejection necessarily. I mean, it might be for you. Like for me, what happens is I'll get a watch, I'll experience it and I'll feel like I've kind of, you know, like drained the glass dry. Mm. And then there's usually a period of disinterest that can sometimes last for years, but I've sold very few watches. And one of the things that I've discovered is that sometimes I'll go back after I haven't worn a watch for like 5 years and I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. I'm I'm really glad I didn't sell it.
I've definitely made the mistake of selling stuff on, like, I don't know, on a whim, I guess, is the option. Like, the one that jumps to my mind, and only because the watch has increased in price in a manner that I don't know is necessarily equal with the experience that it provides versus a newer version of the similar ideas, that, like, my 2254 Seamaster, which is like a perfect, slim, super wearable, great looking watch. I had it on a Speedy bracelet. It was great on any strap, great on. And then I think just for whatever reason, I was like, oh, I want, I think I sold it for like the equivalent of a, maybe a little under 1500 US back in the day. And maybe they've doubled since then. And when you hit start to hit like $3,000, the competition's crazy in pre-owned. Like, you could get a lot of watch from a bunch of different brands that are considerably more modern than the ETA base that's in that Omega. And then, of course, if you buy a 2254 now, it kind of has to go in for service almost immediately, unless it just has been. Just because I'd want to take it and I'd want to jump off docks wearing it. Like, I'd want to dive with it, like all that kind of stuff. And you'd want to get it pressure tested and probably serviced. And luckily, being an ETA base, that's not like a big concern. It doesn't have to go back to Omega. But
James, when was the last time you actually jumped off a dock?
I mean, October of last year.
When was the last time you took a long walk off a short dock?
Frequently. Yeah, for sure. No, it's almost like, I mean, the weather in this exact room we're in right now is absolutely conducive to dock jumping. But we're nearly back to dock jumping season. No, this is all I do all summer.
Do you regret selling it because the cost is now more than you're willing to pay for that same watch, or because it's now the value you would have had to be able to sell it today is more than what you sold it at originally?
I just wish I hadn't sold it at all.
Okay.
And now to go back and rebuy one, especially like now I go back and I go, well, I had the 5.4. What if I get the non-AC, which had applied numerals? There's a titanium version out there that's like even more into the Peter Blake lineage, which is kind of fun. And
I mean, the other problem is that, like, a lot of the time what you want is you don't want to buy like the same model. You want to get back that particular watch that you had because you have a history with it.
I mean, not in this case. I wouldn't say that there was any like sentimental value on this one, but I do understand that being a thing for sure, trying to get the exact same one.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I would stand with, like, trying to think of other stuff that I sold that I kind of wish I had. And like my Aerospace, in a moment of weakness, I flipped my Aerospace and I missed that watch every day. I think I just was wearing a Garmin all the time when I wanted a watch that had some features. And then now I wish I still had that, because they're not worth enough money to really worry about one way or another. And they've appreciated a bit in the last few years, but probably just get another.
You know what I wish I hadn't sold? I had
your soul. It's the devil.
Yeah. You play guitar real well, though. Yeah. Have you seen this guy?
No, I haven't.
Absolutely shredding. Absolutely shredding. It's all like crazy 1/72nd note arpeggios, man. Yeah. Suck it up, Satan. This is a really obscure watch unless you're a high accuracy quartz enthusiast, but I had Pulsar made two high accuracy quartz watches back in the day. I can't even remember the manufacturing dates, but it was the Pulsar PSR 20, which was accurate to 20 seconds per year, and the Pulsar PSR 10, which is accurate to 10 seconds a year, which is, you know, 10 seconds a year was pretty fantastic. And they were not expensive watches. I found one, it must be like at least 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago. I found one, bought it. You know, it ran really well. And the funny thing is, it was really beautifully made. I mean, it was not expensive to buy. The case was really nicely made. Dial was great. You know, it was like an ultra, ultra thin, high accuracy quartz watch, like super, super elegant. I would never sell it if I had it now. But I sold it for like maybe twice what I paid for it. And just because I thought to myself, well, I've had this experience. I don't need to keep having it. You know, it's a cool watch for somebody else, you know, should experience it. And I'm really sorry I sold that one. And I don't see them for sale anymore.
No, I mean, you brought that watch, the PSR 20, up on a recent podcast, and I had to Google. I didn't know it. In our hidden gems, you mentioned it. And yeah, it's definitely a cool thing for sure.
Here's a question for you guys. So obviously, with the value of watches rising so much, I've always been behind. I've never sold a watch for a massive profit, maybe a few $100. Like, I would make a terrible dealer.
Me too.
But I'm wondering if this feeling of regret goes away if you just make a ton of money on a watch. Like, if a watch pops and you sell it. Like,
yeah, it definitely doesn't hurt.
I think it's like money always helps a little bit, yeah, right? It doesn't fix a problem, but it makes the problem less noticeable.
Right, yeah.
You know, I think the one I would bring up is actually a watch I was going to mention to see if you remember it. Several generations back in terms of ownership and functionality, Yema, they did a Seiko-based dive watch called the Sea Spider. So it was it was about 40 millimeters, kind of Breitling-esque in some ways. Like, it had kind of a Baroque bezel. I had one in a blue dial, and I remember I bought that on like Watchy Seek way back when I was I had no money to spend on watches. I paid $150 for it or something. And then like a year or so later, I was like, well, I had my time with it. I'm good. And I put it up on WatchUSeek and I had like forgotten to put a price in the sales. And before I went back to edit it, like I just very quickly put a couple photos up.
They banned you from WatchUSeek for doing that.
I was not banned. Somebody sent me a thing and they're like, will you take like, I think $700 or $800. And I was like, yeah, I was just about to list this for $200, dude, like, just so I could get my shipping money back.
Oh,
like,
my God.
You know, I feel like there's an article in there somewhere about just like strange names for dive watches. This is a little bit of a tangent.
Oh, but, absolutely.
You know, they seem to attract sort of weird, exaggerated, outlandish names in a way that no other category of watches.
I think it's one of the biggest things that people don't talk about in terms of the appeal of the watch is its name. It mattered to me so little years ago. And now so much of a watch's name, especially the brand name, can really rub me the wrong way.
Yeah, yeah.
And something folks don't, and I don't know if we even see it much anymore, but I used to pay attention to it a lot, was case back art inspired by undersea adventures or like caricatures of squids or ocean monsters.
That didn't do it for you or did?
Well, back in the day, I paid attention and appreciated it much more. Now I don't like, think of all the major dive watches that we write about regularly. Do any of them have really cool case back art?
I mean, the Submariner definitely doesn't.
No,
definitely doesn't.
You could make it anything you want.
That's true. That's true. I wonder what the first ocean, again, it's a tangent, but I wonder what the first sort of like ocean themed production engraving on the back of a watch was. Was it like the Omega Hippocampus?
Great question. Yeah, who knows? Like the 60s and 70s were full of very cool ideas. Like, you know, like, contract or label watches.
Right.
But they came up with totally outlandish things like all the Jenny or Yanni stuff had some very cool names. There's also, isn't there actually a Jenny C-Lab? I think there is.
I wouldn't be surprised if there was.
I think it was an Aquastar C-Lab.
Yeah, maybe.
Aquastar C-Lab 300, something like that.
Yeah.
So it sounds like Cole and James, it sounds like you've sold watches a lot more actively than myself and Danny.
100%. That's true.
I'm sitting here listening to it and I'm like, you guys went through a period where in 1 year you sold more watches than I've sold in my entire.
Yeah.
I mean, back in the day when I was before, you know, way, way back when I first got into this and I started writing for Watch Report, I was basically buying a watch to review it and then to sell it and then take that $150 and buy another watch so that I had something. We had no industry contacts. You're kind of out there on your own. And you made little moves to so that I had something to write about. And it does, like, you know, the first 100 watches over a few years, like that's a good way of learning. It's good. You know, you experience a lot of trash. You experience a lot of stuff that people didn't care for, but it does kind of bring you up to speed and it gives you this like visual literacy, especially for like at the time, all it was just as not that dissimilar to now, but it was dive watches.
I mean, let me ask you guys another question. I mean, since you've become, you know, full-time professional watch journalists, I mean, you get to experience watches that you don't have to buy because they're sent to you for review. They're sent to you for coverage with a frequency that obviously was not the case just in terms of direct experience of watches when you were kind of collecting privately and, you know, before you started doing this for a living. Have you reduced your watch buying and watch selling activities?
100% extensively. Yeah, like I hate selling watches.
I will say, and this
hate
is it's really difficult now.
Kind of a larger conversation, but there was a certain, you know, NWA, new watch alert. Like there was a certain excitement about getting a $400 watch in the mail.
Still is.
Well, yeah, there still is, but I don't know if I get the same sort of excitement as I did back then.
You know,
there's nothing like cracking into a fresh Seiko box.
Well, that's true too.
I was just going to say, like, I have a couple of kids, you know, both college age. So like my watch buying activities have been severely curtailed for, you know, purely practical reasons. But every once in a while, I just order a Seiko 5 off Amazon. And like, you know, when that box comes and, you know, you get that little burst of serotonin, you're like,
It does feel good. Even like a G-Shock.
Yeah. You
know, even like absolutely. A $40 G-Shock. I get that.
And I like the low stakes. You know, you're saying buying and selling. I find it, you know, it's difficult now, not only obviously because there's a certain profile that comes with being a writer in the watch world that, you know, people might recognize your name and the rest of it. So you obviously have to operate at a very high standard when it comes to selling a watch. It's a lot easier to use a service like Crown of Caliber, Hodinkee Pre-Owned. There's my plug. But, like I've genuinely had some really strange experiences. When I sold that 2254, I priced it at what I thought was absolutely fair for its condition,
right?
Its requirements for service. Everything was a paragraphs of stuff
under your own name or no?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so like you signed the message, the DMs, James Stacy.
It was on WatchUSee.
Okay, yeah,
and I was selling it actively in Vancouver, like meet face to face. It's all fine. I've worn this watch. It's all over my Instagram, the rest of it. And that none of that's the problem. But then because of how I priced it, which I felt was very realistic, I think it was 18 or 1850 CAD at the time. And it had a few goodies and a cool like Omega zipper case and the rest. But another guy in the Vancouver scene took all the pictures and everything and immediately posted on the same forum another sales post saying that he was going to sell it for $2,200 or something. So he thought he was going to buy it from me for $1,850 and then sell it on a slightly different form. And then immediately people started sending me this saying like, which one is the one that you're selling? I'm like,
this guy needs to take a long walk off.
Kick rocks for sure.
That ain't cool.
So, and then when I brought it up to him, because I knew him, he was like, oh, I do this all the time. And I was like, yeah, but you
that's
shouldn't.
That's not good. Yeah, that's not right.
You're confusing people. And also you're advertising to sell something that I'm never going to sell you now.
Danny, have you ever sold a watch?
I've used a watch as currency to buy another watch. So I've used a Chopard Mille Miglia to...
Nice pronunciation.
So I asked,
beautiful.
So I asked
you... Lear.
I asked you if you ever sold a watch and you said, I have used a watch as currency to buy another watch.
Such a lawyer thing to say.
Well, the reason I say it is because I...
Yes.
That watch came to me.
Oh, do go on.
It was something of a gift... Even though it wasn't really, it belonged to my mother of all things, but she just didn't wear it and had no connection to it. And by virtue of that, I had no connection to it. I did wear it for, I would say, maybe 2 years. Strangely enough, people would notice that watch more than any other watch that I would wear. I think the tire tread rubber strap had something to do with it. And it's got an interesting enough dial. But yeah, when I wanted to buy my GMT Master II, the Batman, and there was some value in that watch. And when I used it to trade it in, I got a pretty nice price to do so.
How much?
About $2,000.
That's really good considering what they sell for.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I don't regret it. But at the same time, maybe I do a little bit only because I felt a little bad. You know, it was kind of a gift. I cleared it with her first. I was like, I'm gonna.
Oh, I was gonna ask, man. Did you like?
I asked. I did the right thing, but I don't really like to sell watches. It's just not my style. Yeah.
There's another concept that we haven't really we kind of touched on it. So selling watches, you can kind of upgrade, right? Like you move. So now that's a Batman. That's a very valuable watch that you might keep for life or whatever. You know,
I plan to. Yeah.
So. Through selling, I mean, selling is a vehicle to get to where you're going, right? So it's not like we just love selling watches. It's more like it's a journey. It's a journey.
it always depends on the person and their personality. Like when I asked all the general colleagues that are normally on the show, some people were like, oh, I've literally never bothered to sell a watch. I just keep them all.
I hate the mechanics of selling a watch.
It's a hassle. Yeah.
It's easier if you're in the States. Like when I sell a watch, I have to be concerned about how to ship it, how to insure it over a border, what that's going to do to the kind of appeal of the watch. So a lot of times you try and keep things in the Canadian system, as it were, federated to that country versus this one or whatnot. So it is kind of a weirdly complex thing. And I think that's why there is, again, another plug, but why there is value in using, especially when the watch is of a certain value and up, in using an intermediary, because then you don't have to deal with having enough posts on WatchUSee to be allowed to post, or putting something on your Instagram and then dealing with DMs and people flaking on you and trying to figure out how to get payment.
Or
and,
reselling your
and
watch
then,
from
and
more
then of course, or that. And then you have the more recent thing. And I think if I don't bring this up, people will mention in the comments is you now have PayPal and these other companies are reporting values over a certain amount.
$600,
right?
Yeah. Anything
so,
in
so
a $600.
Now you're not moving watches to disguise value in any place, especially not in PayPal. And of course, we would never recommend that you do that. Keep your watch as a watch if you'd like to hold its value. That I think that's what we're learning over this conversation.
Or just say that you accept payment only in stacks of non-sequential hundos.
Yeah, bearer bonds. Yeah.
I think other watches.
To solve all these problems, you need to come up with a fake identity. You need to only operate in whatever is non-sequential hundos.
Yeah, or just use caliber.
Stacks of hundos.
Yeah, stacks of hundos. And like, I don't know. What
Danny, is that the only watch you ever sold? Excuse me. The only watch you've ever used as currency to buy another watch.
Yes. I also returned an SKX 009, which I regret. It was within the returnable
returned
period.
It to Macy's
back
or something.
When they were like $185.
Yeah. And I regret it because I think I wanted a GMT Master Pepsi at the time. And I was just like, this isn't scratching that itch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was dumb. I think I was influenced by others to think that way. And now I just
007 and 009 they're like getting expensive.
Right? I have the 007. I wear that watch fairly often, but I regret not keeping the 009.
What was the circumstance? Like, how old were you?
I was like 26, 27.
So not that long ago, 5 years ago, something like that.
Yeah. And I just, it's a thing in the moment. It didn't do it for me. And now I wish that it was still here with me.
Well, I got one. Speaking of buying and selling, I have a few extra SKX 009s, 009s.
A few.
We can make that happen.
We might be able to work something out here.
You're talking to the guy who I sent like one message to about possibly wanting a Seiko Monster, right. And I had one in a few days.
We'll talk business later.
Okay.
All right, Jack, cool. I'm curious. Have you owned anything and then you sold it and you were happy to see it go? Like the inverse of a regret?
I had a very weird experience many years ago when I was not burdened with tuition payments. I had a Royal Oak 15300, which was the first reference that had the 3120 in it, the caliber 3120. And you know, that watch was a big deal.
Yeah.
I got it as a gift, from a company that I was working for at the time, you know, when I started working for them. And they gave me the watch. We had a few drinks. I went home. I put it on the nightstand. I woke up the next morning and I put it on. And much to my shock and horror, I just felt nothing. Like, I felt nothing. I didn't feel nothing. Any.
I'm empty
nothing.
Inside.
Cold and empty inside, and this watch isn't fixing that.
That's right.
It might actually be highlighting it.
It was actually making things worse. It filled me with a creeping sense of existential dread and an awareness of the pointlessness of human existence in a random and infinite multiverse.
And it's telling the time.
And on top of everything else. And, you know, like, it's a great watch. I mean, it was an objectively great watch. The caliber 3120 was like a huge deal when it first came out. I mean, I remember showing the watch to a guy who was a watchmaker for Patek Philippe, and he was like, oh, good movement. And I was like, you know, I felt like validated for like 47 seconds, then I was right back to existential dread again. And so anyway, I finally sold it to make a tuition payment. The only thing that I regret about selling that watch is that I didn't wait so that I could sell it for
more tuition payments.
And like, you know, again, this has nothing to do with like, you know, how I feel about AP, which is a company I respect enormously, sure. Obviously. It doesn't even have anything to do with how I feel about the Royal Oak. I might have felt completely differently about that watch if it hadn't had a white dial. You know, if it had like a blue dial, or a salmon dial.
It was just.
I looked at it and it was like I felt like I was looking at the surface of a frozen pond with like a body barely visible beneath the surface.
Wow!
You should write the PR copy for AP. Yeah, that might sell a watch.
They're not going to move a lot of white dials under that messaging, Jack. We might need to workshop that a bit.
I'm swayed.
No. I mean, it's like it's not you, it's me. Like that's how it was.
It reflected the frozen tundra of your own soul.
Wait, but Jack, to bring up Cole's question, when was this?
Oh gosh, probably 10 years ago.
I feel like today you might not have made the same rash decision.
We all could have owned Royal Oaks 10 years ago.
And was it, here's the important bit too, is you said it was a gift from the employer. Was it kind of a signing bonus, and was it semi used as a financial instrument? Like,
I don't, in what sense?
Statute of limitations.
I mean, I just want everyone to know
laws,
in a past life, I did work in AML, anti-money laundering. So if anyone wants some tips.
I actually did too, very briefly. Yeah. A very short tenure.
I should leave this room.
Yeah.
No. I get it. I mean, not really, you know, I mean, I obviously felt, you know, grateful and incentivized to work hard and, do my best. Although I always do that because, you know, I have a work ethic.
But was it designed for you to sell? Like, it's like,
oh, no,
maybe
no.
We can't pay you X, Y, and Z, but we'll give you this watch.
Well, you have to remember, this was back before like the Royal Oak became the thing that it is today. Like, you know, I don't know what the street price back then was versus the street price now, but I bet it's a pretty big delta.
Pretty vastly. It's vastly
multiple.
Different. Yeah. It wasn't down payment on a house back then.
And it certainly it would be now, I think.
I was trying to think of a non-regret, something I was like very happy to sell. And the only thing that could possibly come to my mind is definitely not anywhere in the same vein as a Royal Oak. But I every now and then I convince myself that I can wear a white watch, like with a white case and a strap. And
like a fully white watch.
Ceramic?
No, this is just like, I think the last time I tried and I learned that lesson. I think we'll see. Okay. was a like a white G-Shock, like a sort of M&M style,
yeah.
White 5600, And I've talked about this recently on a podcast, but I literally got it out of the mail and I was like very excited. And I owned a couple other G-Shocks at the time. So it's not like I didn't know what I was getting into. And I took it out of the thing and I put it on my wrist and I walked like one lap of my home at the time. And I went, nope. Right? Took it off, put it back, like took one photo, it was $40, right? Like took one photo and immediately put sold it to someone I knew on Watch You Seek and moved on. I mean,
maybe if you lived in Florida instead of Canada, you would have kept it.
Actually, I own that 1995 Apple Watch that I wrote about last year.
Yeah.
And when I bought that, it came to me with the original rubber strap that could not be on the watch anymore because it had crumbled. But the seller still sold it to me with it in a little tiny like dime bag with just crumbled bits of rubber strap.
Complete with original strap.
It's like those fake Star Wars toys where it's just one of the burnt up bodies of Luke's aunt or uncle.
Yes, I'm also
just
using
little charred bits in a plastic figurine case.
My watch purchases on the podcast.
Man, it's the best is when you buy a pre owned watch or a vintage watch from somebody and it comes and it's got like it's clearly got the shed epidermis of many previous.
I don't want this on the show. I don't want this on the show.
Let's talk epidermis.
We've all seen it. We've all seen it.
Yeah, but it's not fun to talk about. It's gross.
I'm having a great time.
God, I had something to say off that point. I won't say it. All right.
No, we'll go move on.
I did get a watch in for a review recently where it had clearly made the rounds.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That definitely happened.
been rode hard and put away wet.
Rode very hard. When you take like a paper towel to the back just to make sure, like to see, is that what I think it is? And it rubs off.
Yeah.
It's not a great
probably
feeling.
What happened was someone, the brand told someone to send that watch to you and they were like, Danny Milton from Hood Inc., I'm going to wear this thing out in the mud and stuff and then send it to him.
It's extra humid today. I'm going for a run in this leather strap.
It was it was done on purpose.
Yeah.
You could DNA test that stuff and figure out exactly who it was. Worth watching for you.
What is it? 23andMe or whatever.
You guys are all fired. this is the last Hood Inc. Radio.
What's the topic of this pod?
I don't remember. Grossness in watches.
It was buying and selling regrets, but now it's turned into like, you know, some kind of weird hygiene biology thing.
I do really regret that SKX-009. And now that we've been talking about this,
you
for
snap
a while,
one up, go for it.
I gotta talk to Cole later.
Yeah, Cole's got cameras.
So you mentioned plastic degrading over time. This is it's a well-known problem. And I think Uncle Seiko solved this problem, but the Z22 and then the GL straps, they particularly get crumbly and non-functional. That's the problem with those watches specifically.
Speaking of rubber straps and Seiko, I do think people complain about the OEM rubber straps on SKX.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking
especially
about.
Especially the Z22.
I can tell that would happen to them over time.
Yeah.
But I do like them because they don't attract dust the same way that some of the other straps do.
They're like a harder compound.
Much harder. Yeah. They actually don't, like no dust really gets involved in that scenario.
If I want an SKX, I want it like on a jingly jangly.
Yeah, I wear it both ways.
Dime store Jubilee with rolled links and that's the way it goes.
Do you though?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, all right.
I like feeling it jingle jangle around.
I thought you would.
It's like an old
throw it on.
Oh my gosh,
or something.
I bought a
for sure.
Speaking of Seiko fives, I bought an Arabic dial Seiko five.
Oh yeah, actually, that's a cool piece.
The big one and the smaller one, just because at that price, why not? Why make a choice when you can have both? And it was the jingliest, jangliest bracelet I have ever put on in my entire life. It was like three times louder than an SKX 007 bracelet. I mean, it sounded like freaking Marvin's
ghost. It's like putting a bell around your neck.
Yeah.
I bought one of those watches too, off Watches of Espionage's recommendation. And
they're cool.
I had it PVD'd for a magazine story.
You're kidding.
So it's the Seiko 5.
I don't know why I'm saying
dial.
You're kidding. It's like not that weird a thing to do.
And actually, I just saw the story and saw the photography and it's awesome. This is a watch that begs to be PVD.
Cool. Are you going to sell it?
I can't really sell it. Also, that was a $138 watch.
Yeah.
So like, do you really even want to sell something like that when there's...
But this is a situation where you can find out exactly how much the Cole Pennington name is worth. Like if you just sell it as a, a blacked out...
I don't believe in that. I don't
think... But if you sold it as the Cole Pennington...
That's good, ridiculous.
Don't tempt him. He'll do it.
So that brings up an interesting question, provenance. Like I actually am of the school of thought, some people buy a watch because it was owned by X, Y, and Z. I would rather put my own stories into a watch.
I'm with
you. Don't think I want to buy someone else's watch. You know, like So I never really got that.
Wait till you're as old as I am and you realize your entire life is empty of meaning, and then you'll take all the borrowed glory you can.
I'm a huge proponent of pre-owned watches. I think that the world has a lot of things that aren't made to last, and watches, even inexpensive watches, can literally last as long as you're willing to take care of them. And I think there's a lot to be said, not about necessarily sustainability, but about preserving things that were designed to be made. And sure, I don't think that means you have to keep the watch forever, but I like that there's a buying and selling aspect to this. I like that about cars. I like it about garage sales. Like I'm wired for this.
I mean, look,
you're going to be a dealer soon.
There's watches. There are watches.
Be a terrible dealer.
There are watches in the British Museum that are 450, 500 years old, you know? And it's perfectly possible that 500 years from now, somebody's like, Orange Monster is going to be in a museum.
Can I turn this conversation to, is there one watch each of you regret having the opportunity to buy that you did not buy?
I can give you a long list here.
I just said watch one. That's on your wrist. I knew this could be a separate podcast.
The watch that's on your wrist, I turned down for a song. I could have bought two for half the price of what they're selling for now.
And that's a tell them what it is.
That's a 14270 Explorer for those.
I had one 14270 offered to me for a few grand. Also a 114270 on a Jubilee, also for a few grand. And at the time, I was kind of like, oh, I'll think about it for the afternoon. And then I just didn't think about it anymore, and I moved on. And it was a mistake. I should have bought both.
Yeah.
Man, in the early 2000s, back when the 26th Street Flea Market was like, had a lot of watch dealers there. And, you know, I mean, the Rolex Submariners alone.
Right. You know,
there was somebody selling a IWC anti-magnetic ingenieur, you know, the one with the 500,000 amperes per meter magnetism resistant. And like, they were selling it for like $800, which was a lot of money for me at the time because I was still in graduate school. And I remember looking at it and thinking, it's kind of small, you know, and like $800, I would have snapped that up in an instant.
But that brings up a good point, because I had a situation once, I think it must have been like 2014-ish. I had been wanting to buy a Batman for years. When I finally did get it, I was really happy about it. But this was when I was first starting to look. And I went into a Rolex boutique in Europe, actually, and someone was like, we don't have one, but here we have this. And they pulled out a Hulk, like still in the plastic that it comes in with the styrofoam or whatever. And my reaction was, no, I don't like that one. You know, but that's what I miss. Like, to your point, like, oh, it looks small. I had an opinion unencumbered by anything else, you know? Like, right. And I feel like watches have now reached a level where...
I'd still say that if I was offered a Hulk today. Yeah. I don't like that one.
I think it's trading. It's something like near 40K.
Crazy. Yeah.
I miss to be able to just have a straight up solo opinion on the aesthetics of a watch, whether or not I want to wear it or not. Period.
But you know, like, this is a really interesting point, Danny, because it's absolutely true. I mean, the demand is so high now, and it's become so difficult to find really, really popular models that like that factors into your perspective on a watch when you see one and when it's offered for sale. And, you know, like back in the day, and that day was not all that long ago, to your point, you know, it was still possible to look at a watch and, you know, and pass on it just because, I mean, regardless of the street price, you know, you would pass on it because it just wasn't for you.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the maybe one that hurts more now that we're really going down this sad chapter of our lives, but was the Explorers that I turned down was one thing. I spent a lot of time trying to buy a Sea Dweller, a 16660, still probably my favorite.
It's
modern-ish.
It's so good. Yeah.
You know, I love that little nod where there's no Cyclops. And I could tell from the other side of the room that it's not just a sub. And I think maybe I was in the negotiating range of like between $5,000 and $6,000. What a huge mistake. I didn't have $5,000 or $6,000 that could go unaccounted for. I would have had to sell watches and figure some stuff out, but that's the fun of it sometimes, right? Especially an upward consolidation. I'm always a fan of.
That's an upward consolidation. So what I was talking about earlier, the journey is actually simply upward consolidation.
It's not a side hustle for anybody. It's just proving that this is an addiction. We're using other watches to continue.
This reminds me of that person who started out.
I was going to say same thing, the paperclip.
Yeah, they started out with a paperclip
on Craigslist and ended up with a Porsche Boxster.
So like,
or he might even have gotten a house after the Boxster.
He ended up with a house.
Yeah.
So like, what
that was a great story back in the day, early internet.
At what point do you abandon upgrading just through watches and start upgrading, you know, like other stuff? Like the watches become cars, and the cars become homes, and the homes become several homes.
Well, I'm not at that level yet, but I've definitely sold cars to fund other cars. The trio of Flighties that I was talking about, I actually sold to fund the GMT Master too. So I've had this thing 2 years-ish now, and actually, do I miss the Flighties? I miss them a ton. However, this is just the way thing. This is how things go, right? I mean, like you need
give
money.
Up a collection of. Yeah, watches.
You can't win every
That's
one.
That's interesting.
Right? I gave up. Yeah, three flighties.
Yeah.
So
and a that qualifies
one 9-10 in a professional iteration. So I had the yellow cadmium hands, and then two 9-11s, and sold all three of those to buy this watch. So it didn't hurt as bad, you know?
Yeah, and you love that watch. I do. Master.
And
yeah.
This touches on something else. It's like, less is more sometimes, and I'm finally getting there. Like, I would like to consolidate down to two watches. Consolidate up.
Yeah. No, that's a specific pressure that kind of comes and goes for me. If I don't look at my Pelican case of watches very frequently, then I stop worrying about the fact that I have so many watches that I don't wear that frequently. And some of them have emotional value. Some of them just aren't worth enough. Like it'll be something I'll give to a sibling or a niece or a nephew or something like that down the road. But other ones you're like, oh, I could list that. But then and then you have to go through the whole headache.
That's the thing, you know, like my watches at this point are either watches that it's not, there's basically two categories. One is it's not really worth the effort trying to sell them unless I sell like a lot of them and I don't want to go to the trouble. And I like them anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, plus what would you care for if you weren't making sure all your G-Shocks were charged and getting their atomic signal.
You have no idea.
Your garden of G-Shocks.
That's right. I have them. It's like they're sitting in a roses in a window box. Mm-hmm, you know, like yeah. I literally have them sitting in like not one but two windowsills in my house.
Just
you know?
Wait till the next tuition payment comes, Jack. We're gonna see some Jack Forster
specials.
It'll be
one windowsill of watches. lot only.
The Jack Forster windowsill collection of G-Shocks.
That's right.
But then the other group that I have is watches that I the high value. Higher value ones are watches that I am really, really in love with. And I'm not interested in selling them. I mean, they're keepers. Like, my yellow gold Day Date. Yeah. I have a Tank Louis Cartier, which, took a while to get. I mean, even if you have the scratch, it just takes a while for to get delivery. And like, I don't want to sell those watches.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I have a Louis Vuitton smartwatch I don't want to sell. You know, just because like every once in a while, if I'm going to take a walk around the block and it's after dark, it's a really fun watch to have
yeah,
on.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and there is that fun. And I'm sure some people listening to this don't understand half the perspectives we've shared on this because maybe they're not buyers or sellers. Maybe they're smart enough to have picked one or two great watches and then put on the brakes. But the movement in and out is kind of like the core of what I love about this.
Fun.
I like experiencing the new watches. I like my return to the Monster. I like having a couple that have like worked out long term that I really love. My Explorer 2, I get a message once a month asking like, hey, they're worth this much money now. Like, you think they're finally going to sell it? And I was like, I don't care. But like, this is the watch I've always wanted and I've got it. And I'll definitely not be able to buy it again if I sell it.
You know what this makes me think is that there's like, you can have a collection without being a collector.
Right? Absolutely.
Like, I don't think of myself as a collector. I have like, I basically have bought watches that I like when I see a watch I like and I can afford it. And that's just what it boils down to.
Yeah, and I don't have any shape or form.
Yeah,
to what I do.
It's not like I'm like avidly collecting, you know, yellow gold Day Dates or avidly collecting vintage Tank Louis Cartiers or even avidly collecting G-Shocks. I mean, I have a collection of G-Shocks because it's really easy to have a collection of G-Shocks. And if you think G-Shocks are cool, and I do, you know, you can end up with a lot of them. And it's just really enjoyable to see them all sitting in the windowsill.
Yeah, for sure.
But that doesn't make like, you know, we know a lot of people who are real collectors who. Like the whole transactional part of it is like part of the fun. You know, it's like a big part of the
specificity
fun.
And themes and stuff.
Yes.
I'm an enthusiast.
Yeah. And if you get deep enough into something to be a big C collector, that typically means you're also part of a network that these watches bounce around in. So it makes it a little bit easier if you want to sell something really high end or really just sell something in general. You've got a little network on your WhatsApp or whatever that is your first point. You know, something like a forum would be way down the list. You'd go through your buddies, and then after that, maybe their buddies, and then after that, a Crown and Caliber, a Hoodie Keeper, something like that
too. You know, just straight up swapping.
Like I think, you know, who I think of in the context of collecting with a capital C is that guy you talked to in Thailand with the Seiko collection.
Oh, fantastic! Oh,
yeah. I mean, that's real.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, I think the theme here is scholarship paired with ownership. Like people.
Yeah. And specificity.
Yeah. And specificity. Right? Exactly.
There's no, like you would look at my Shim Sham quote unquote collection and you'd be like, you didn't start with a plan and you don't have one now. Yeah. You're fired from the hips. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Same way for me. I'm trying to get down. Right. But I would say the Flightmaster is the only watch where I did that with. I felt like the more I learned, the more I wanted the next iteration and so forth. And then once I did amass all of them except for the gold one, I let them go. So yes. What does that say? I don't know.
I mean, I collect the way like a tribe of hunter gatherers in the Paleolithic gathers food. Like it doesn't. As long as it's in what region? Like,
in Mesopotamia or Tigris and Euphrates.
Well, hunter gatherers in the Paleolithic. Yeah. Could be any of them. But you know, like it doesn't matter if it's like, you know, grubs or roots or, you know, the least rotten part of the rotting carcass of a deer that was killed by a European lion. You want something that nourishes you. And there's a lot of different things that, you know, that sort of nourish me in terms of horological enthusiasm. But I don't know. I mean, I would actually find like collecting necessarily means narrowing your focus to some degree. And sometimes it's narrowing your focus a lot. Like collecting just Seiko monsters is a pretty narrow focus, but there's also so many of them that you can really, really enjoy building up a collection.
Sure.
And not feel like you're deprived of anything.
Same with G-Shock. Like the fact that you can start an actual collection let's not even just say G-Shock. Like there's some Casios I adore that are $35. That A500, the little world timer you can get in gold.
Yeah.
I bought like three of those. I just keep giving them away, but I love getting them.
Yeah.
I also
cost less than a pizza.
I also bought three of them and I haven't given them to anyone.
There you go.
I'm like, hey, look, it's three world timers. It cost me a lot less than like dinner for me and my wife.
For sure. A good watch strap is going to cost more than a handful of those watches. Like it's fun that you can get into this for not that much. And then if your sickness, if we'll call it that, scales like it does for other people, you just get in over your head and you just kind of keep treading water.
You know what makes a watch that you've had a while feel like a brand new watch if you haven't worn it in a while is just putting a new strap on it.
Oh, for sure. Or digging out the bracelet if it's been like several years and you're like, oh, I did buy this on a bracelet. Sometimes I do that just for the change of pace.
I found when we just had our apartment painted for the first time in 20 years, which is something I probably shouldn't admit in public because it had gotten like things had really gone downhill over the course of 20 years and we'd accumulated a lot of crap. And I was going through all of my stuff and, you know, a lot of stuff I boxed up and put in storage, a lot of stuff, you know, we tossed out, like all of my books from grad school, which are like 25 years old, I got rid of because it's like they're ridiculously out of date. And I found two Tudor boxes and I was like, why do I have two Tudor boxes? I only own one. I only own one Tudor. Oh, God. And it took me 2 days to realize I actually own two Tudors.
Are you serious?
Were the watches in the box or no?
No. They were just around. The boxes were both empty.
But under like, some G-Shocks.
I have like so many watch boxes in my apartment and so many watch cases. And the fact that it took me 2 days to remember that I actually had two Tudors and I was mystified by finding two boxes, that says something about like just how far gone I am.
Yeah. I mean, in most scenarios, that story, I don't know, wouldn't make me feel super happy. Right. But because it's you, it's just, this all checks out. A surprise Tudor.
It was like literally 36 hours before I started thinking, wait, do I actually have two Tudors? Wait a minute. Let's go check.
What are they and will you sell them to me?
One of them is a Ranger and no, and the other one is a Black Bay the last year that they used Eta movement and alas.
So you forgot you owned the Ranger, I'm guessing?
I forgot I owned the Ranger.
Yeah.
Ranger's a good watch.
It's a great watch. I was like, you know, then I found it and I was like, oh man, this is a great watch.
It's like you got to buy it twice, but you only had to pay for it once.
Yeah. And they're both valuable watches, right? They're both discontinued.
Are they?
Yeah.
You have the
Eta Black Bay, right?
It's gone. Yeah. The smiley dial. Yeah.
Jack Forster Tudor Ranger. Can be yours, Dan.
There we go.
Well, look, guys, this has been fun. It didn't go in any direction that I necessarily planned on, but I think that's kind of perfect. We don't get to do these face-to-face that often. I think the lesson here is... maybe don't always record podcasts in rooms that are hotter than the Serengeti at midday. And also,
has anyone else's body adjusted to the heat in here?
I'm pretty comfortable, but I'm in linen.
You know what? I think the heat actually kind of brought us together. It's like we're all in a sweat lodge together with a little ayahuasca, and it's like, oh, brother.
Another 20 minutes, we'll all be remembering watches we forgot. Exactly. All right, guys, this has been super fun. Thanks so much. And like I say, if you're listening and you enjoyed this episode or any of the episodes, all I ask is that you tell a friend, send them a link, let them check out the show. And other than that, we'll chat to you in about a week's time. And if I have the schedule correct, it's a pretty cool episode. So get ready for that. And Jack, Cole, Danny, thanks so much.
Over
Thank
now.
You, gentlemen.
Thanks, James.